You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. My name's Stuart Goldsmith and this is the third of my series of four brought to you live from the Just for Laughs Festival in Montreal only last week. Now this, ladies and gentlemen, is probably the podcast I've been most excited about since I did the show. This is Patton Oswalt.
So many exciting things happening in aluminum siding this year. Glad we could get together again for our 11th annual. The AS. I just wanted to think of an acronym and I totally...
Oh, you blew it.
No, headbutt.
It's just...
Also, I love the phrase, try to convince comedians that they're unhappy. That you would need to even attempt that.
Well, some of them are. I think that...
I'm going to try to get Keith Richards to have a drink. I'm going to somehow convince him to have some booze.
We're going to start with, we've got loads to talk about, and we're going to start with some of the things we were chatting about backstage that we kept going, put a pin in that, hang on, we'll do that, we'll open with that. So you've been to the UK in the past.
Yes. Well, okay, I've been to the UK, I've had a great time there, except for my debut, which was a nightmare. This was back in 2000, I was at the Hammersmith in Shepherd's Bush.
The Hammersmith Apollo.
Hey, thank you. Yes, the Hammersmith Apollo. That's the UK version of the Apollo up in Harlem, I think. They open a satellite room out in Hammersmith.
That is exactly correct.
So I was touring with Amy Mann and Michael Penn on this thing called Acoustic Vaudeville. And what it was Amy Mann, amazing singer-songwriter, as is her husband, Michael Penn. They love performing. They hate doing banter between songs. They just don't know how to talk about as they're tuning and stuff. So they would have comedians open for them and then come out and do their banter in between. And we would just say whatever we want. It made no, like, you know, this next song is about the fact that the ring-tailed squirrel is currently endangered. And if we, and then they would have to sing like...
That's so beautiful. Yeah, it just give you license to come out and dick around.
Just literally anything. I was in a really dark place when I wrote this next one. and then it was just some happy tune about being in love. So... we get there and they've done their sound check and everything's great. And so the house manager says, okay, we're going to have you go out. And I said, okay. Have you been on stage at the Hammersmith?
I have, yes.
Okay. So the way the lighting, it is a truly grand space and it's very intimidating. In my mind, I'm, you know, this is the UK. I want to work here. I want to do well. So, the way the lights are, you just cannot see the audience. It is just, it's a sheet of blackness and then the stage. So I go out and I do a couple of bits and I get nothing. And I, not only, when I say nothing, I don't even get the weird, like, feet shuffling and that kind of, I mean, it's just silent.
Just
They're not making any noise and it's really unnerving. And I'm, so then I do that thing where, and you've gone through this. All the spit in your mouth dries up. You start talking a million miles a minute because now you're freaking out a little bit. And so I keep going. And then from the back of the room, I hear people starting to talk like they're talking to each other, which, again, is also silence. And then just pleasant conversation is terrifying. Just people going, well, we'll just wait for this guy to be done. Where should we get dinner after this? Like you're just not there. And the talking starts moving down towards the front of the room and gets louder and louder and louder. And I'm just flipping. And I can't stress this enough to you. I have not gotten a laugh. There has not been a single, not even one, like, ah, like a polite anything. Just pleasant conversation at a cocktail party. And then at the very, very end of my set, I did my closing bit, and I got just the most polite kind of, the bare minimum laugh. And then I go, okay, well, thank you very much. And Amy and Mike will be out of here in 2 seconds, so thanks a lot for coming out. And I put the mic in the stand, and I come off stage, and the house manager goes, okay, well, they're almost done seating, and we'll wait another 10 minutes, and then well, you can go out. And I go, what do you mean they're almost done seating? He goes, oh, yeah, I opened the doors 5 minutes into your set. I said, I'm sorry, what? He goes, you went out there. I couldn't see what the audience was. So in his mind, and again, I don't think he had any malice towards it, but there are people, in their mind, comedy is just ambient music. You just walk in. But what it meant was an audience entered the Hammersmith Apollo, and there's just this lunatic up on stage, finishing a joke that they haven't even heard. Like, it almost looked like the janitor had wandered up there. You know, and that's why Count Chocula is pro-life. And they're just like, what the fuck? Don't say anything to that poor guy, you know.
I really hope there is a venue manager podcast, and somewhere in the world, he is telling the other half of this story right now.
Let me tell you the worst comedian. Or he's going, let me tell you the worst comedian we ever had. He went on there, I gave him a 5 minute head start, and then the audience walks in. But they all just came down and they settled in, and they were, again, it's a British audience, they're very polite, and no one was mean to me, which, again, if someone had just acknowledged, like, what the fuck are you doing, I could have maybe spoken to them, but as it was, I just had this. So that was my UK premiere, and then but then luckily we went after that to Galway and Dublin. And those audiences were amazing.
And present.
And not only present, and I'm going to say something that I hope doesn't piss any of the comedians in the room off, because I could not be more anti-heckling. I'm anti-heckling. And Irish audiences are the exception that prove the rule. They know, you know, like when hecklers go, I was just trying to help the show. And that's, oh, you're like, you fucking, that doesn't help the show. Irish hecklers will help your show. They know how to heckle. And I don't know, maybe there needs to be some Irish heckler that teaches a clinic to American audiences to help them focus. Hey, let me show you how an Irish heckler helps a show. I was, again, doing Amy and Michael's banter. I was at the Abbey.
Yeah,
the place, the Abbey. And so every time I would go on stage, I would come back out to do banter. Someone would hand me up a Guinness at the lip of the stage. So I, in the space of about a 2 hour show, I had 11 Guinnesses. I drank 11 Guinnesses. And then they did two encores. So for each encore, I was given a Guinness. So for the second encore, I went back out, and now I've been handed up my 13th Guinness. And I go to the mic and I say, this is my 13th Guinness of the night. And the guy in the audience went, pussy! And it was so, like, that's perfect. Like, that was the perfect button. It actually helped. I laughed. So,
Are you in a position now as a comic where, and I feel like over listening to your last five albums, mm-hmm. I feel like over the last 10 years that I've listened to those albums, I don't know if that exactly replicates the time, uh-huh. but I feel like I've heard you grow as a comic and grow as a person, and you're talking about getting married, and then you're talking about wanting a kid or not wanting a kid and then having a kid. Are you now in a position where you are, I don't want to use the word an elder statesman of comedy, but you're someone who, like, you're getting, we're at the Just for Last Festival, you're receiving an award for being the best guy.
I think they're giving me that just to get me to come up here. I don't think that is any, I don't think that's any indication of merit at this point. So, but that's, it was nice of them.
But you're in a situation now where comedy to you is a very different thing than comedy is to a lot of working comedians at the moment. Do you think that's right? You're seeing
it is a different thing for me because, and any, you know, any young working comic will can tell you this as well. You are, if you're present on stage about what is going on with you right now, I look at my albums and as stand-up comedy and my specials as issues of a magazine. So do you want to see how I was in 2003? Listen to Feeling Kind of Patent. It's a total portrait of I'm young, I'm never getting married, fuck children. I drink 7 scotches during the show. It's just like listening to this train wreck. And then in the In the next one, I'm about to get married. I'm a little nervous about it, but it's going. Then I'm a dad. So you're seeing it'll be like, so when people say, "Hey, you were saying in your first album, you said A, B, and C, and now you've done A, B, and C." It's like, do you find issues of Time magazine from 1976 and then write them a letter? Excuse me, Jimmy Carter is not president. I don't know if you know. I just read your 1976 issue, and I think there's been a couple of presidents. You know, so. Comedy is a different thing for me now at age 46 in the year 2015. And in the year 2020, it'll be whatever I say to you now will be totally null and void. I'll be on to something. I mean, and I hope it is. I hope I'm not still up there doing it. Would be really sad if I reach the age of 50 and I'm still like, kids are bullshit. And here's another thing about Star Wars. And people are just like, the fuck happened to this guy? Aren't you 50? So, yeah, stuff should change. You should change while you do it.
I noticed something. I was reading Silver Screen Fiend.
Still available.
Still available in electronic bookstores and real ones as well.
And real ones. All three of them.
You were talking about being with Louis C.K. in Toomla in Amsterdam.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you said that you were, because much earlier on in your career, and you said that you felt like the big ideas that he was saying in simple ways, I'm paraphrasing probably badly, you were saying that the big ideas that he was saying in simple ways made you feel really terrible about the way that you used or deliberately ornate vocabulary and cultural references.
Well, yeah, because I was young and I was super insecure and I was trying to prove how you can always tell, not always, there are some young comedians, you know, people like Kyle Kinane and Morgan Murphy and people like that, that they are so raw from the get-go that it makes someone like me jealous when I look back at how insecure I was and how I was trying really hard. Because when I was a really young comedian, if you notice, all my comedy is about, this is stupid, and here's another situation where I had the perfect thing to say, and, you know, look how amazing and smart I am. And it's not, at least for me, this isn't true for every comedian, but it's not till you get older that you get secure enough up on stage to just go, all right, listen, let me tell you about this stupid fucking thing I did. And, you know, and you're willing to explore some maybe dangerous or unpopular ideas, or maybe just go, how will you make that funny? Well, I'll find a way. I've been doing this, you know. There's a British writer named Alan Moore, and he said something really interesting, which was when people call me a genius, I think genius gets overused a lot these days because stuff is so mediocre that if you're actually good at something, people go, you're a genius, you know, because things are so crappy. He goes, I'm not a genius, but I'm an excellent writer because I've done it every day of my life for 30 years. I'd better be good at this point. People go, you don't outline? Well, he goes, no, not anymore. I can just kind of start. I've done it enough. So Louis at that point, and also, you know, Louis had only been doing it a few more years than me. He's just so much more advanced than I was. He could talk in much bigger, simpler ideas without all the pop culture frills and bells and distractions that I was using, and the, you know, the 25-cent words and the sub-reference to show you how it was almost like I was trying to scare people into laughing at me, like, I don't want to look stupid, you know, like in case my joke didn't work. And then I would watch people like, you know, Louis and Dave Chappelle, they get at these much bigger cosmic truths with really, really simple language. Yeah. It's just, you know, as you get older, just what you do. I just read Stephen King's book 11/22/63, and I hadn't read any Stephen King in a while, and I was just stunned at how, I mean, I loved him coming up, but you read his early stuff and he is trying to make his fucking name and throwing everything out there, and now he's confident to, I know how to tell this story with just the most, I know how to hit things with the biggest impact using the littlest gestures. So, you know that, but that's, you don't get that until you do it for a long time.
Well, I remember when I read that, I thought to myself, oh, that's, I sort of felt, I was disappointed. I was like, oh no, the ornate language, I really like the ornate language. The stuff that you're doing with the cultural references, it is multi-layered and it has loads of, you know, there's lots of stuff to it. It didn't seem to me to be as cheap as you were describing.
Well, I mean, I'm a little better now, and I hope I can spot the difference between using ornate language and sub-references, where it's coming from actually something personal and emotional, as to the difference when I'm using it to prop up maybe not the most well-thought-out bit.
Okay.
You know, yeah. I remember this very early on, and this was when I had literally been doing it for 2 years. I was driving to a gig with a comedian named Tony Woods out of D.C. Really, you guys know who Tony Woods is? So he was telling me this story about this. He goes, I want to do this joke tonight about, and he had literally had a fight with his girlfriend who was the mother of his child like that day, and he had thrown something at her in rage, and it almost hit her, but it almost hit the baby, and then the baby started crying. And it was this really dark, complicated story, and me, I think I was like 19, I was like, how are you going to make that funny? And he just said, I'm a funny motherfucker, man. Like, yeah. I'll find a way, you know. So, and by the way, I read the afterword to Stephen King's 11/22/63, and he said, I the first version of this novel, I wrote this in 1978.
Yeah.
And I realized I don't have the tools yet to do this. I haven't hit this point. So he put it in a drawer and waited.
Have you got equivalent bits? Could you recognize anything from your most recent album or from the stuff you're going to do tonight where you think, oh, actually, this is something that I've had to put down and come back to?
There was a bit on my last album There was a very, very specific bit that I tried doing a version of very early on, and I could not. Now I can't think of what it is. There was another bit that I was working on for my last album that I dropped out of it because it wasn't there yet. About why do mega celebrities go crazy? And I was trying to link it to, like, does reality start to warp at that point? So that's why you burn your life down. But it was just, I just haven't aged into that bit yet. I just wasn't ready. Well, very, very early on in my career, before I did my first album, there were versions of the Black Angus bit that I kept trying to build, and it just never, ever clicked. And then it finally did. It finally.
Remind me of the. I feel like I know your work very well, and I don't remember which bit.
Well, it's about the commercials where there's a chain restaurant. You probably have equivalents in the UK. It's these chain restaurants where the appeal of the restaurant is not that the food is good. It's that the food is a lot of food. That's the why you come in there. So this place, Black Angus, and I mean, I do an exaggeration, but it's not that exaggerated. Where they, you know, we start you off with our. Yeah. Deep fry. They scoop out a pumpkin and fill it with shrimp and then dip the whole thing in. It's just, and it goes on and on and on and on. Yeah. And I had seen stuff like that on the road as a comedian. I was like, this restaurant could be an alien spaceship and they're fattening up humans. And at the end of the night, they're just going to rise up and just slaughter them all. It looks like feed pens for, you know, for how to fatten up people. But I could never find the approach. And then years later, I finally figured that out.
So
there's got to be comedians in the room where you've got something where you're like, I know there's something there and I can't. Fuck, it just doesn't. Does anyone have that? You know what I'm talking about? Well, just, you know, think of an equivalent of a drawer, the writer's drawer. Just file it away and keep chipping at it. It will come. And sometimes it'll just come because you get older and you'll go, oh, that's what I'll, you know, that's what it is. So
something I've noticed that is a real skill of yours is in taking, like just that kind of analogy, taking an existing situation and finding a ludicrous, not necessarily science fiction oriented.
Right.
But like a good example would be the bit about singing in your car. So is a very, like, I don't think I've ever heard a bit which has as much made me go, oh, for Christ's sake, I do that all the time. Why didn't I come up with that? So the premise, if you like, the first premise is that you sing when you're in your car and you sing a load of nonsense and it would be insane if anyone heard it.
Right.
And then you take that and nest it within the idea that would, like, because that's a you know, an interesting and funny observation.
Mm-hmm.
But you always seem to kind of go one further and instead nest that within the idea that this would be the tape played at the CIA Christmas party if they were wiretapping you.
Get the newest Oswald.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, especially if you're in show business, there is a narcissistic element to your head and to your thinking of, I'm the star of this movie. In your mind, I am building this artistic career. And now that I'm there's a podcast called Rejoice about the writing of Ulysses. And you get into, you know, but you realize that James Joyce kind of lived the same way. Like, oh, I'm the hero of this movie, and this will all. And he was a complete prick to everyone he knew. I try not to be a prick to people, but there are those days when I'm going, this is going to be a scene that'll get replayed later on in the Patton Oswalt story, because you can't help to think that way sometimes. Otherwise, you wouldn't be in show business. So I'm like, what if that? Go ahead.
I just wanted to ask. So did that aspect of that bit occur to you at the same time? Did you clock that?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm singing in my car. That's one thing. And then later on, you're like, oh, that would be interesting. Or did you go, I'm singing in my car. Why am I doing this? Oh, and why am I noticing it? And it's almost like was that a multiple observation that came to you?
Yeah, and it also came to me from, you know, I was really, really paralyzed by a lot of my bad aspects that I just did not like about myself. I didn't like my competitiveness. I didn't like this egotistical, you know, I am the center of the universe and here's how I'm thinking of it. And, you know, and it was really making me not want to even function, because I was just like, I'm a dick, like I'm the bad guy in this. If this is how I literally can't stop thinking that way. And then I was talking to my shrink, and he said, yeah, everyone that's artistic thinks that way. That's how you get to the artistic stuff. You got to wink at that shit and make fun of it. Okay. You can't let it paralyze you. So then that gave me that insight, was like, okay, so now let's look at some of my dickish behavior. And what if I, what's the funny part about it? And, you know, and then it helped me control it. And that was one of the very first moments when I was driving. I mean, and I still do when I drive my car, I make the most nonsensical. It is crazy. And then I'm just, well, why hasn't someone put a, or if it, again, that's my thinking. Well, you know, if the CIA were to tap my car, and really I'm a dangerous crucial comedian, wouldn't they do, like, in my head, I'm going to spark the revolution with my bits about Black Angus. So of course they put a mic in my car. The FBI file on me, just, it's my picture and then dilettante. That's all it is. So what if I take that to the extreme?
Okay.
You know? Then also took the extreme you said, which was, then I'd become a celebrity within the CIA listening post of, like, we got a new Oswalt, you got to hear it. So...
Because obviously when you do that bit, part of the reason people are laughing before you get to the CIA element is they're laughing with recognition at the observation that they do, that they themselves also do that in their cars.
Yes, and I think that's another risky but really rewarding thing that comedians do. A lot of times, and again, comedians in the room, back me up, I'm sure you've done this, you throw out a premise, A, to get laughs, but B, to also go, hey, I'm not alone in this shit, right? Like, yeah, I just want to make sure. So when you throw that out and the audience all starts laughing, you're like, thank God I'm not fucking, like, oh God, I thought I was crazy. But absolutely, when they all start laughing, you're like, oh good, okay, I'm okay, thank God. Whew. So yeah, that was one of those bits that I kind of throw that out, like, is anyone else think this way?
Okay.
And, yeah.
And let's look at the writing, at the creation of those bits. From the moment when you have that observation, are you the sort of, or how has it developed over the last 20 or so years? Are you the sort of person that will just keep that idea, keep a note of that idea, and then talk it through on stage?
Yes.
And then go away and edit it? Because some of the stuff seems to me to be so densely written and so full of punchlines and so full of paradigm shifts that we get another laugh from when the perspective changes again, that I just think to myself... I mean, I've listened to it going, you that cannot have tumbled out.
See, I so wish I could say I sit with a notebook and I write my stuff out. I wish I had that kind of discipline. It doesn't come tumbling out, but it gets teased out night after night. So whenever you see me perform, there are bits that are just there, but you also will see the process of new bit, and it's this constant... cycle of bits becoming really solid, and then I get bored with them because I know they're going to work and there's no risk anymore, and they begin to phase out. So each album and special, I try to time it where I'm at the peak new stuff. I've got 45 minutes of stuff that I know will work, and then I begin folding in the new stuff, and I'm like, might work, might not. And I wish I could say I'm, because some of my favorite comedians sit and they write their stuff out and it is gorgeous, but it's teased out bit by bit.
Okay. So just to use a different example, so, and another of my favorite bits, when you're talking about jock rocking your life, and so you're singing to yourself.
That was another thing that it was almost like, what those bits, that and the inside the car thing, those are almost a form of prayer, where I'm saying a prayer from there. It's like, but someone else just back me up on this, please, so that I'm not. So that was another thing. And when I do it, people are like, fuck, I do. And when I hear that recognition in the audience, it calms me down.
But specifically, the examples you use, so the premise, the setup is that you find yourself singing along in a kind of COD jock rock style. And you do three examples, one of which is eating a sleeve of saltines in my bathrobe.
Underwear.
Watching Carlito's Way.
Yeah.
And that just killed me because, like, that's Carlito's Way is the perfect choice of movie because it's always on. You always watch it.
It is one of those TBS, TNT, why? It's 4 o'clock on a Sunday.
Yeah.
So why is this? Well, of course it's on. And you never see it from the beginning. You just turn it in halfway and you're kind of eating crackers. You're like, this is an hour of just nothing. I'm getting nothing from this.
So my question is, is Carlito's Way something that came out on stage, or is like you used a kind of other film first and then you went away and went, what's the perfect film?
I think it was, as I was doing it on stage, it almost came to me subconsciously. In my head, I went to sitting on the couch in my underwear, and then just Carlito's Way, of course, was on in the vision. That's what would come on. You know, it's almost like if I had done that bit in the 70s, it would have been either Soul Train or The Longest Yard. What is always on TV on the weekends for some reason?
Okay.
And for some reason, Carlito's Way just...
So it's about experiencing, like putting yourself imaginatively in the moment and filling in as much detail as possible.
Yes. And the fact that when I say Carlito's Way, the audience goes, oh shit, I think I've done that. You know, or they recognize Carlito's Way. I've seen that. So yeah, that's happened to me on a Sunday.
So this is Patton. I don't think I've ever been happier as a podcaster than when Patton walked into the green room backstage, and I'm there biting my nails, wondering if he's going to turn up, freaking out about doing someone who's legitimately my absolute comedy hero. And he walked in, and it's just he and I in the room for 10 minutes beforehand, but he walked in without a handler or an agent or anything else, and he looked at me and he just went, Stuart. And that the way he said it seemed to go, look, I know you're excited about this. Don't worry. It's all going to be fine. We went on to have just the most fun. I love this episode, and I hope you're enjoying it too. You can follow Patton on Twitter, @PattonOswalt. You can go to his website. If you're not familiar with his work, and I have to accept he doesn't have an enormous profile in the UK. I hope this show goes some way towards rectifying that. He's enormously famous in the UK amongst the alt comedy scene. He did Comedians of Comedy. He's in the current series of Veep. He's done 5 or possibly 6 albums now. And every single one of them is an absolute gem. So look him up on iTunes, look him up online, and let yourself discover just how exciting and how magnetic his comedy is. He's up there with my absolute favourites. I would say top 3 of all time. So grateful to Patton to Patton for coming along. And very grateful for you for listening to this one. I'd like this one really to be massive. So more so than any previous show. If you're listening, wherever you're listening, if you're in the States, if you're in New Zealand, Australia or the UK, wherever you are, please share this one with a friend. I'm so proud of this episode and I really want as many people to hear it as possible. If you know any Americans, let's use this as the first leg in an onslaught on America. If you know any American comedy fans, not comics, and comics as well, why not? Then share this one on their Facebook pages, send them an email, direct them to this show, because I think they really are going to appreciate this as much as I did. And as much as I hope, and I think actually Patton did as well. So that's enough fawning for now. We'll get back to the episode in just a moment. Remember, the Phoenix Fringe is happening all this week up until the 8th of August in London. So you can go along to the Phoenix Fringe and find out more information at phoenixfringe.co.uk. That's got people like Milton Jones, Ardlo Hanlon, Shappy Corsandy, Kerry Godliman. If you're in London, you absolutely shouldn't miss that. If you're in Edinburgh, please come along and see my own show, An Hour. That is happening every day at 4:55 at the Cannon's Gate. That's a free show under PBH's Free Fringe. So come along to that and get there early on the assumption that it's absolutely wildly rammed every day. And there is a bunch of live podcasts happening, of course, up at the Edinburgh Festival for the second 2 weeks, the final 2 weeks of the festival. I'll be doing some live comedians with people like John Lloyd, Tommy Tiernan, Ronnie Cheng, Catherine Ryan, Daniel Sloss, Jason Byrne, loads and loads of people. So come along and see those, absolutely free as well. That's everything I need to tell you. Thank you to everyone for donating. Much appreciated. Your donations keep this show alive, and they're really important to me. That's the only income I make from this show is you supporting it, busking style, by crowdsourcing, as Amanda Palmer would have it. You can go to comedianscomedian.com, click on the PayPal donate button, and you can donate whatever you think this show is worth to you. If you're a student, chuck us a couple of bucks. If you are an employed person, why not throw me 5, 10, 20 pounds, or the dollar equivalent? And if you're someone who's an absolutely rabid fan of this show and you've listened to every episode and downloaded them all to CD and played them in your car, if you're obsessive, like I know a lot of you are, then feel free to just drop me however much money you want. That's your way of saying thank you, and this is my way, and the continuing production of these shows is my way of saying thank you for supporting it. I really appreciate it. A little thing beeps on my phone whenever I get a donation, and my heart beeps every time someone finds me in a gig, says something cool, and presses some cash into my hand, so feel free to do that as well. Your donations pay for the people who can't afford to donate, and they're what keeps this show going, and it's making me so happy. It's making me so happy that you like it, you want to support it, and you say nice things about it to me. If you can't donate, just share it with a friend, give us a 5-star rating on iTunes, or just send me an email, info@comedianscomedian.com, telling me if the show has made a difference to you. I think 21 is the current running total of people who've started doing comedy. This show has just given them the nudge to start it themselves. So feel free. And remember, if you're one of those 21, the rule is that 10 years' time when you're playing arenas, you book me for support. Hashtag Goldsmith for O2 Tour Support 2025. So that's all for now. Let's get back to the final section of this episode with the absolutely sublime Patton Oswalt.
What kind of things in your writing, speaking as someone who, like, we've already described that idea of the florid language, you feeling you need to make sure you don't overdo that or kind of spot yourself doing it. Well, what other kind of tropes are there that you catch yourself doing? What sort of habits do you have as a writer that you need to keep an eye on?
That's weird. I was just starting to make a list of those because I'm very, very aware there is, when you find stuff that works, there's a safety element to it that you want to go back to. So using using emotions as nouns, when I describe the KFC famous bowl or whatever that thing is.
A
sadness pile and a failure bowl. So just the idea of sadness as a noun, a sadness. Well, that was an adjective, but then I've also, so I'm just very aware of falling back on that I'm going to equate something with a massive, massive emotion. And then also certain movies that I always subconsciously reference, Blade Runner, Star Wars, The Road Warrior comes up a lot and stuff. Brian Dennehy came up a lot for some reason. He just did. So I'm very aware of it and I'd make sure not to put him in there anymore. I think the word douche nozzle showed up in a couple albums. So just, and again, if I may quote Alan Moore again, once you recognize a thing either in yourself or when you see other people quote, when they quote you or talk about you, they go, well, he'll talk about A, B, or C. You've got to get rid of those things immediately. You have to do without them and form new strengths. It's hard, but you got to do it.
Are there kind of like this, you've identified a number of words there.
Are there
kind of in the bigger picture, are there sort of kind of joke formats or particular structures that you find yourself returning to?
Wow, that's a good, one structure that I'd use a lot, I just really like it because I love the turn aspect of it, is you back into something without, you say a premise that is not an immediate lead to anything.
Life is full of what ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? United Healthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
You can't tell where this is going to go. So like me saying the word like robots, or I start a bit where I end a bit and then non-sequiturs. Or I'll just go robots, or the bit about G-rated filth where I just add it with no setup, just go, I want to fuck your hot puss. And I'm leading up to it, but I like the shock of what the hell is this? And then you turn it into, I had a whole opening like that, I think, where I just said, remember when you were a little kid playing games and they would say the boundaries are lava? And there's no joke. That's the thing of how long can I go without any obvious joke? And then you twist it and then it gets a huge laugh. Like, I want to see how long that can go.
Okay.
So that's a thing. And it's on my, the last album too, about the, my daughter watching the Wolfman remake. And I'm all afraid that I've scarred her for life. And it's a pleasant story, but there's where is the joke here? And then it's almost like the idea of like the squirrel at the side of the highway going, how do I get a thrill? I'm going to run out and try not to get killed.
Yes.
So how long can I take them before they get, you know, they turn on me, and then you turn it and get a laugh? That, to me, that's just so fun.
I wonder. I heard on another podcast, which I will find out which one it was and duly credited. But someone told
you are the James Lipton of interviewing comedians. You do your research, man.
Thank you very much.
I mean, I'm serious.
Can someone?
I'm sorry. I've been on podcasts where the host is literally scrolling through my IMDb. So you were. I'll edit all this out.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I was going to ask, though, I think it was, you weren't on the podcast, it was another comic talking about a piece of advice you'd given them. And the piece of advice was to make the moment of, that there be a moment of realization inside the story. And as soon as I heard that, I was like, oh my God. And every bit of your stuff I listened to after that, I went, there's one, there's another one. It's not just as simple as, and then I realized, but it's taking like an existing situation or emotion and then pulling back from it and putting it in a, not just a wider bit, but a wider.
It's the, this took me some time to learn. There's a couple of bits in my first album that I would love to almost revisit and pull back into a wider realization about it. But in other words, instead of making fun of something going, this is stupid, just pull back a couple of steps and either find out what's great about this horrible thing and embrace what's great until you strangle it and get a laugh that way, or pull back and then look at, why am I so obsessed with this? Why am I the reason? And I think
why am I bothering to talk about
why is this? Does it mean that they've won if I've... I mean, that's the realization I come to in Silver Screen Fiend, that I don't come to it in my George Lucas bit on my second album, which is, yes, the prequels were terrible. I've spent months talking about them with my friends, with people online. I don't think I've created any piece of work, good or bad, that's caused this amount of discussion yet. So, you know, who's the loser here? Who's the artist? So, you know, keep pulling back and asking those questions. I think that's what's really, that makes comedy really fun.
What was the first bit that you wrote that you thought, this is who I am? That you went, this is it, I found me.
Fuck. Yeah, because you know what? There were some early bits, and I bet a lot of comedians in the room could cop to this. I had early bits that worked, but they had nothing to do with me.
Yeah.
It was just, oh, I know this will work. I know this will... I think maybe the first bit that I wrote that really was like, okay, this isn't just me going, well, this is stupid. You know, me actually finding delight in something beautiful or trying to find something funny and human in something kind of ugly was I did a bit about, there was a American TV show called Cops. Mm-hmm. And for some reason in the early seasons of that show. And if you go back, you'll see this. It's a little disturbing. They really seem to have a fetish for busting guys with prostitutes and then telling the guy, telling the John that the prostitute that they were with was a guy. And they would do this over and over again. It was like this weird, and here we come. And so I talk about the guys, and usually these guys are just these macho, like, redneck dudes, and they're then being told they were making out with a dude. And the realization coming over their face, there was something so, and I do that, like, the face as he's realizing it, that there was something kind of beautiful about that, that, oh, as awful as you know, maybe this is to you because of your very narrow upbringing. Whether you like it or not, doors and windows are being kicked open in your head and maybe you'll become a better person, you know? Yeah. So that was the first time that, and I remember I did that on my very first special, and there was another joke that I did in that special that the director said, you know, this joke, I know this gets a laugh, but it has nothing to do with you. All it is just a clever turn of phrase, but it's not you up there. And the joke was, I like my women like I like my coffee, tied up in a sack and thrown in the back of a donkey by Juan Valdez, which it's very clever, but anybody can make that joke. There's nothing yes. about me in it. And the other thing is, you're talking about an experience you had, albeit you're watching television, so I don't know how much of an experience it is, but you're thinking, you're trying to sympathize with someone else, you know, that other people would normally just dismiss or go, ah, what a fucking loser. You're like, well, wait a minute, let's, you know. So that was the beginning to me of maybe let's try to have more empathy and look into other people's, look at it from their experience and then get bigger laughs that way.
There's a bit of yours where you talk about the open mics when there's the guy on heroin who keeps phasing in and out of... It's a great story.
Dr. Pepper.
Yeah. So the phrase, you wouldn't give a cripple crab a crutch. This is stuck with me. That's not a real phrase. You made that up.
No, he said it.
Incredible.
You wouldn't give a crippled crab a crutch. isn't that gorgeous? And then that's gorgeous. The way that rolls. Oh, it's like a Wallace Stevens poem. It'd be so happy. Sorry, go
when
ahead.
When you're doing that bit, you talk about, you identify the three different types of comics at the open mic.
Yes.
Him being one, the insane lunatic. The first group you mention is those who are going to make it and get somewhere.
Yeah.
And then the middle group is, they're funny, but who gives a fuck?
Right.
And it came up in a conversation, I was interviewing Moshe Kasher yesterday.
Oh, nice.
And he said that. We talked about that concept and that bit. And we were talking about whether or not, I mean, he describes it as intrigue, whether there's something, that's the difference between a comic we give a fuck
that's
about
a
and it
is. Great way to put it, yeah.
Yeah.
There's no intrigue in that second category of the guy that it's a man or woman that's gone up and they know beforehand that this stuff will work. It's like there are certain summer tentpole movies where there's no intrigue. They've literally, you can tell they've crunched the numbers beforehand and say, we have this many foreign sales. We hit these 8 or 9 scenes that we know everybody wants to see. We will make our money back. This is a calculated product. There's no, you know, whereas other movies are like, wow, they really rolled the dice on this one. So I think that's the difference too with, there are certain comedians where you go, that person is not there right now. They are delivering jokes, but these are can't miss concepts that no one's going to like piss themselves laughing at it, but no one will not laugh at it. It'll just be exactly, yes, for you know. And so it's the person that goes out on a limb and takes the risk or and you also watch somebody forming. It's, you know, you feel like, oh, I almost want to follow this person and see what happens. Mm. That there's something going on up there.
I was
intrigued. That's a great way to put it.
We were, this is the most term for it. But we were wondering, I was wondering whether it's possible to, I think he was talking about recognizing that he had some intriguing quality before he really had any kind of good material. And he was being told he was taking too many risks. And we were thinking, if you're a comic listening to this who feels that they're in that second category of like, I'm funny, but who gives a fuck? Uh-huh. Is there any way you can break out of that? Or are you doomed to be intrigueless? What is
take? I broke out of that. I was a funny, but who gives a fuck comedian for the first 4 years of my career. I was terrible. I mean, I was getting steady gigs. It was all, the stuff was working, but there was nothing. You would never leave one of those. The first 4 years of my career, you would never leave one of my shows and go, I got to follow that. I got to see that guy again. You just go, well, that was funny. Now what? Like you would have forgot me the second you stopped seeing me. And then what happened for me was, and I think this is a difference between some comedians. I moved to San Francisco. This is in the summer of 92. And I did an open mic at a place called the Holy City Zoo. And in the room were people like Greg Barrett, Greg Proops, Margaret Cho, Lankin Earl, just these people doing this amazing, risky, weird, really funny stuff. And I went up and I did my A-plus road material, and I ate it in front of people that had just, I had just watched for 2 hours, who destroyed me. And then, so it was this, total, if I may bring up James Joyce again, but there's a moment at the end of his short story, The Dead, which is one of the best stories you'll ever read. But there's this guy who's this very full of himself, and he's a singer, and he has this wife, and he's like, well, the wife loves me, and I'm a huge celebrity, and everyone kind of worships me, and I've got this amazing future ahead of me, and I have all these dark levels to me. And he's just very, very full of himself. And then at the end of the story, his wife is crying, and he's like, what is going on? And then she tells him out of the blue this story about this young boy, Michael Fury, that was in love with her when she was living out in the country and kind of died for her, and she's never forgotten him. And it immediately shrinks him. Like, he never thought his wife had any other dimensions than to just be an appendage and a decoration for him. And he actually realizes, I'm not the star of this story. I'm the appendage. She has the bigger depths. So it was this moment in the Holy City Zoo for me where I'm this up and coming. I kill all the time. I do great. I'm in this room. Wow. Hey, these people are really fucking good. Well, wait till they see my shit, because this is awesome. And then to have that totally like, oh, wow, I am not only am I not the center of anything, I'm 4 years behind what the cutting edge is. And it was this really great wake up call for me that I'm really glad I had. But I think there's some comedians that they get that wake-up call and they either recoil in horror from it, and or worse, they dig their heels in twice as hard with the shit they're doing and become successful doing their shit. And they think, well, if I make $1 million doing this shit, then they'll respect me. Mm-hmm. And then they end up even more furious because the truly artistic and risk-taking are like, fine, have your $1 million. I don't want to do what you're doing, and then they really get pissed off. So there's that, if you're really, really willing. And, again, I'm talking like that was my big epiphany, and I was okay. That shit happens to me all the time, and I hope it never fucking stops. I was very, very much against a lot of especially now, these past couple of years, I've had this very cool education as far as like trans issues and race issues and misogyny and all these different levels of things that I thought I had. Well, I'm totally progressive and liberal. I've got all this shit checked off. I know where I stand. But then when you talk to other people and you keep seeing these new viewpoints, mm-hmm. you keep getting shaken up. And if you stop getting shaken up, then you're just kind of done as an artist.
Yeah.
So I think every few years, the structure has to collapse, and you have to go, oh, I didn't know shit about any of it. And then you got to keep rebuilding. I think that's what's really good.
When you had that moment of going, holy shit, the Holy City Zoo moment of going,
This is going to sound like it didn't happen, but it did. I went across the street to a restaurant called Taiwan on Clement Street. I had my notebook, and I tore pages, all the pages out of my notebook that had my jokes on it, and I threw them in the trash, and then I had like 15 pages of blank pages left, and then I just wrote, because it was May 5th, so I wrote May 6th, 1992, and got up the next day and just started writing all new bits.
And what was the difference in those bits? Were you writing those bits? I want to find out exactly what changed. You write another bit, you write a new bit, but how is that different to the bit you've just thrown away? How is it more true?
What do I think is funny rather than, okay, what is going to guaranteed make an audience laugh? What is the audience thinking? I stopped thinking about what the audience was thinking. And I also started respecting them a lot more. That was the weird thing. The minute I stopped thinking about what the audience wanted, I ended up respecting them way more. Because then what I did was I treated them like they were intelligent. They'll just shift gears and go along with what I'm going to. And they always rose to the occasion. Now, not that I'm saying that I brought this extra level of intelligence. I mean that I would just brought this honesty, like, hey, here's this thing I was thinking of and here it is. And they always went, okay, let's go with it. Because you just started having a little more confidence in that. Right? Don't run from the truth.
For the benefit of the listeners, someone just tried to leave.
Yeah. A juggler just stomped out angrily. I'm kidding. It was horrible. Jugglers are the backbone of our industry.
Regular listeners to the podcast will know that I myself am quite an accomplished juggler.
Oh, dude, are you a juggler? Oh, shit.
It's my old life pattern. We don't talk about it.
Oh.
I almost never bring it up.
Fuck.
Not on stage. Not as a comedian. Not professionally since I became a comedian.
It would have been great if I said that, and then like you look and like three juggling balls like roll out, and it's like, oh. And we pull in, there's like a little tear.
I get three circular tears tattooed on my chin. Talking of those kind of like my early years hacking out kind of street shows, your early years hacking out pre-Holy City Zoo revelation, pre-that night cafe moment, were they worth anything besides money in your pocket, confidence? I have a pet theory that comedians end up, we want to work hard. We see that if you work hard, there are career advantages. But a lot of us end up working, and this is my stupid way of describing it, rather than working hard, we end up just working much.
Yeah.
I mean, we just end up, you can feel like you're working. If you've got an 8-hour road trip, you can go, well, that's today's work.
Well, a lot of people also, they confuse struggle with work. They think, well, look at me, I'm struggling, I'm trying so fucking hard. Why don't you just...
I'm currently turning to glass and shattering. I think I've done that for my entire life.
Oh, well, I mean, I do too, but I have to keep reminding myself, why don't you just like work smart rather than create all this struggle? Because no one gives a fuck about your struggle.
Yeah.
Just work smart. And, you know, again, it gets back down to the... Here's the great thing about those 4 years of just doing, and I did every, the mechanics and the reality of going on stage didn't mean anything to me. So it was much easier for me to then jettison everything and start fresh because I was no longer thinking about going on stage.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I'm trying to think of an example of a great artist that started off. Well, okay, you know, the Beatles, one of the reasons they were so amazing was because they did 8-hour shows every day at a Hamburg strip club before they ever were the Beatles. So they had, and just cranking out, I mean, they do compete. Imagine you have to entertain angry Germans that are waiting to see tits and you have got to somehow hold yourself up there. And they were playing any song they could think of. So by the time it was ready for them to write their own shit, they're like, we've got all that stuff out of the way. I know every chord. I know how to do that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm ready to start, you know, doing this. So, you know, there's a great, you know, there is total value in just going up and just cranking it out sometimes. That will lead to, you know, doing it.
Is there any danger, do you think, in you becoming, like this is something you see with a lot of very popular comedians, that the sort of the starting point of a comedian is to be an outsider. And
yes.
The more successful you become, the more you become an insider.
Yeah.
People, you've over 2 million followers on Twitter. People respect your opinion about things. And actually, you're no longer on the outside of culture looking in. You are the culture.
Yeah, and you also have access to stuff you used to make fun of. So it's very hard for you. Like, there are certain maybe items of pop culture you would like to trash, but you're like, 4 of my friends are in that.
Yeah.
And I kind of can't do, you know, it's really weird. It is really, you know. So, yeah, there have been moments when, oh, yeah. But again, you know, you just have to be honest with your situation. And also, you know, I hope when I'm older I'm not still just totally focused on pop culture. And also you find better ways to, you learn, you pick better targets, you know? Because yeah, when you're coming up and you're like, oh, this, it's hard for me. One thing that's very hard for me to do is to make fun of movies with the abandon that I used to, because I've either been in movies or I know people that make them. And I know even the shittiest movie, people have to break their backs to make it.
Mm.
So it's really hard.
Even Deathbed.
You know what? I was contacted by the actual carpenter that built the deathbed for that movie. He's this old guy. He still exists. And he still runs a carpenter. He goes, I worked really hard on that bed. Like, I wanted to make it look nice. He was like, because he was going, I'm making something for a movie. I'm going to do a good job. And so it was, I can't really go, look at this fucking loser. He really did work hard. So, you know.
So then just before we wrap up, just talking about your transition into being a movie actor. Again, you go into a lot of detail of the early days of your movie acting
My movie acting. Yeah. My early days. By the way, when I flew here yesterday, it was on the plane. Me, Rob Schneider, and Harlan Williams were like, is this a down Periscope reunion going on? And I said, if Rip Torn gets in this plane, I'm getting off because it's going to crash.
But you... In your stand-up, you talked about there's a routine about turning down constant offers to play the gay best friend.
Yeah, so, I had a couple of those offers. Well, it's just that I was, you know, I have a lot of gay friends, and when you hang out with them for as long as I have, and you see that how, again, they are just as complex and complicated as any other person, and then you read a script, and they're literally written as a pet. They're just a pet, and it's so gross, and you're just like, I can't, this is just, why don't I just play something in blackface if we're going to be this, you know, dismissive and reductive? So, yeah, there have been, and again, when I say I'm turning around, it's only been in the last couple of years that I've had the luxury of turning down a role. You know, I've done a lot of shitty stuff. So there's, you know, it's not like I'm going, please, I'm curating. I want a perfect IMDb. You know, no, I'm not going for the John Cazale 5 for 5, but, you know, there should be some, you always should exert some choice sometimes. It was just hard for me. I wasn't even judging the movie. It was just like, I know that this thing I'm about to play doesn't exist. You know, like, I'm not, if I was doing a fantasy movie, I'm not going to go, I'm sorry, there are no werewolves. I can't play a werewolf. But these gay eunuch friends that are just there to help out some white girl find love, it's just bullshit. I just hate that so much. In movies.
And is there an element that you, your stand-up following, you need to kind of, what am I asking? It's about integrity, I guess, and it's just about whether that the fact that you're a successful comedian who does openly hate and be disgusted by things, yeah. You know what I mean? That's a very open process for you, whether it's on Twitter or whether it's on
Well,
in,
sometimes
in
also, you've got to be very, I mean, again, it comes down to being totally honest. There's a bit on my last... album where I talk about I whored myself out to a casino.
Yeah,
holy shit! And I am very open about I did it. And there you go. And you gotta, you know. So yeah, this is ultimately a business. You have to. I don't want. By the way, I'm never judgmental of my friends when they take work. You have to work. I don't want to see people. And again, a lot of the work that I do, like. I remember early on some message boards, there were some real comedy purists going, you should have quit King of Queens after that pilot and told them to go fuck themselves and worked in a bookstore. And then I was like, well, if I had done that, no comedians of comedy.
Yep.
No, like all the stuff that I was able to finance myself, all that was all King of Queens money. That paid for the stuff that I wanted to do. So I don't know why people have to see the artist that they revere go through a hard time and continue to go through it. Because, you know, for the most part, unless I'm like...
Yeah, we don't want our artists to be happy. I mean, our good artists.
Well,
we connect with them maybe at times when we're unhappy. And if see them swanking around...
No, but I wasn't using the King of Queens money to buy a swimming pool in the shape of Bill Hicks's head. You know, I was like using it
that
to
later.
Do this, you know,
this Ratatouille money.
There you... Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, you know, it's so that you can have more freedom to travel and do things on your own terms. So, you know, that's, and again, and yes, if that sounds like a justification, it is a fucking justification. We go through that shit all the time. And I'm telling you, young comedians, you will all come to that crossroads. You will all come and you will all fail like I did. There are no Howard Rourkes in this room, and do not read the fucking Fountainhead. It'll screw you up. I read the Fountainhead on the set of Down Periscope. It was the biggest mistake I've ever made. What the fuck was I thinking? I was like, I gotta burn this studio down. No. Be happy you're getting your SAG card, you idiot.
I've got two more subjects, and we'll have cover them very, very quickly.
Yeah.
You don't need to apologize.
No.
One of the things, as I mentioned at the beginning, one of my obsessions with this podcast is how people cope, how comedians cope with the various troubling aspects of comedy, with the isolation, with life on the road, all the rest of it. And I'm very fond of ambushing people and saying, are you happy?
I'm happy, but I'm happy for a really... this is going to sound kind of selfish, but and I've always I know there's the stereotype of the comedian crying into the cracked mirror in the Motel 6, you know, while Eric Carmen's All by Myself is playing on a fuzzy AM radio. But I'm really fucking happy because I picked a profession where I get to hang out with comedians. I hang out with the source of jokes. I'm not hearing it the second day at the office after someone watched it on a TV show the night before. I'm with people. I'm on the factory floor. I'm watching the stuff get created. So ever since I've been able to make a living just doing stand-up, and I mean, like, I think in early on, I think I made, like, $14,000 in 1 year. And I was like, it was barely enough. I could, like, pay my rent and feed myself and keep my car running. I was totally happy. I'm like, this is great. I don't have to go to an office. So I've been – everything else is just gravy. I'm never – I mean, I'm a little bit bummed if I'm on the road too long and I'm away from my wife and daughter. I like being home with them. But when I'm on the road, I'm with a comedian I know usually, and I get to watch them, and I get – you know, so that – and all my friends are fucking comedians. It's great. And the ones that are sourpusses, I just avoid them. So it's perfect.
But does the instinct, or did the instinct to become, the drive to become a comedian, was that intended, do you think now, looking back, was that intended to heal something within you? And if it was, did it work?
I don't know, but I think the only thing I need healing is just the fact that I moved around so much as a kid. So there was a lot of that, you know, kind of being in new places a lot. But and yeah, I used humor to cope, but for the most part, I mean, yeah, I mean, I guess I, you know, I said this before in a little short film, you know, you want to be loved and understood. But I think that's, I think everyone kind of has that plight on some level.
I'm particularly aware of it when I speak to comics who work as hard as you have and mm-hmm. do, who are driven like that.
Well, I'm also driven because I want to get to a point of power and comfort where I can start. There's other things I want to execute. Yeah. I have a lot of stuff that I've conceived, but I don't really have the means to execute it yet. So my drive is to get to a point where I can execute what I conceive. And so there's a lot of stuff in terms of television and films and stuff like that. But then also, you know, I want to say the reason I did Comedians of Comedy, I want to facilitate. I cannot stress to you and anyone listening, the field of stand-ups coming up right now, like the younger generation, is fucking staggering. They're so, the talent level is otherworldly. So if there's anything, if I can stay maybe not even relevant, but just successful enough that I can, you know, oh, this guy opens for me and that she opens for me, like, and get more voices out there, it just makes it more fun for me. If you keep really intriguing, intelligent people going, then it kind of ups the bar for everyone. But if you don't do that, so there's also part of that too. I just love doing stand up. I like getting on stage and performing. So doing movies and TV is so that I still have the cachet that people want to come see me. And I don't have to depend on going to a comedy club on a Wednesday to do nonstop radio and then work with some guy that I don't know. Like, I like to build my own shows. And not that, look, I still do comedy clubs, but there's a certain way of doing it that can get depressing. And I don't want that to happen. That's like one of my big fears, is that I'm suddenly in, you know, well, when you're at Cranberries here in West Virginia, we always have the morning guy, the dog, come in and opens up for the comedian. You're like, oh, fuck, this is
you
like.
Always stay in the Frog Hotel.
And let's stay off of politics. You can talk about Obama if you're mean to him. And you're just like, oh, fuck, I can't. So I never want to have to deal with that shit.
So finally, then, your ambition all the way through the Silver Screen Fiend, and you mentioned there as well, making short films, you want to direct.
Yes.
So where are we with that? Where are you with that at the moment?
We are, still kind of...
I'm projecting back to you the energy of you in that book. Come on, Patton, come on.
I know. I'm going to make some short films a little later this year. I'm, like, writing little scripts and stuff. But no real big inroads right now. I mean, it's, you know, I'm still, it's summertime. My daughter's about to start kindergarten. I'm kind of focused on that. I'm also kind of realizing that there are friends of mine that I can just go, hey, I have an idea for a film, let's go do it, and I can go do it. I just, there's always, it's going to just come down to, you know, it took me a year to get on stage as a comedian. I was like, I'm going to do it, I'm going to go out, and then I would start watching comedy, and then I just did it. So it will come down to that. I'm just going to start shooting something, and it'll probably suck, and then I'll make something else, and it'll be, and just go that way. It'll just, it will happen, but I've stopped trying to figure out when, but it will, and it'll happen this year. I won't let 2015 perish without having made something on film.
Okay.
That's my only goal.
Well, I'll hold you to it. This is a comedian's comedian, final question. Look, a very final quick one.
Okay.
What would you have on your comedy gravestone?
On my comedy gravestone? God, I want to think of something funny.
I mean, that sort of works.
Oh, no, you know, I want to think of something. Oh, I just thought of something. How about There's My Light?
Meh. That's great. Oh, man.
All right. Yeah.
That's only the comedians laughing at that. And
yeah,
the regular folks are like, don't
get
it.
Everyone else is like, I didn't know he was a Christian. That's weird.
Exactly.
No, I thought he was an atheist.
That's
weird.
That's exactly how it should be. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Patton Oswalt.
Thank you. Thanks, guys. Thank you so much.
So that was Patton. Thank you so much to Patton for coming on the show. Thanks to you for listening to it, for sharing it with your friends, and for supporting this podcast as you do with your time, your energy, your feedback to other people, your recommendations, and on occasion, your financial support via the PayPal button at comedianscomedian.com. It's all very, very much appreciated. I loved this episode. I properly pinged around the place on adrenaline afterwards. Patton's manager came up to me later that evening and told me how much he'd enjoyed it and how much Patton had enjoyed it. And it just really started to feel like I'm dipping a toe into the waters of American podcasting. So if you're in America, please feel free to herald this, share it around the place and bang on about it until people are genuinely annoyed at you. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Nathan Wood for co-producing this show. Tomorrow, the final live podcast from Just for Laughs in Montreal will come out, and that is with the wonderful Andy Kindler. Again, not an enormous profile in the UK, very, very well known and respected in America and Canada, and with good reason. He's been in the business for an age, and he absolutely knows his stuff. We're going to talk about the Hacks Handbook, that was a satirical thing Andy created in the early 90s. I will include, in fact, a link from that to find a PDF where you can download the Hacks Handbook. It's very, very funny. And it's frightening how similar it is to our list of new hack that used to be on the ComCom page. You can tweet me at ComComPod, email me info@comedianscomedian.com, or check out the webpage to comment on this site and continue the discussion on Facebook. Feel free to do that. Thanks for listening. I'm going to have a little sit down and reflect on this with some sort of glass of booze. Speak to you soon.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for ways to win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.